The Foreign Policy Association presents America Looks Abroad, an analysis of the current news given at this hour on Sunday afternoon by officers and staff members of the association. Through research, education, and discussion in the field of international affairs, this nonpartisan organization, which is open to all who are interested, presents accurate information on world events. Today's speaker is David H. Popper, Research Associate of the Foreign Policy Association. Mr. Popper.
Good afternoon. While Soviet troops continued their slow penetration into Finland last week, the eyes of the world were turned far from the main battlefields of Europe's two wars. In Geneva, the delegates of 40 countries gathered to resurrect a League of Nations most of us had given up for dead. For a brief moment, its voice is heard above the din of conflict. And in South America, off the coast of Uruguay, naval guns barked in an encounter which sent the German pocket battleship Admiral Graf Spee staggering into Montevideo Harbor for shelter in neutral waters. The connection between these two events may seem remote at first glance, yet they fit closely together in the interdependent pattern of world affairs. As you know, the League Assembly denounced the unjustified aggression of Soviet Russia against Finland. It appealed to the members of the League to aid Finland, but without telling how or to what extent. It declared that the Moscow government has, by its own action, placed itself outside the covenant. With this go-ahead signal, the League Council last Thursday, indulging in some rather arbitrary parliamentary procedure, proceeded to read Russia clear out of the League. The Finns were disappointed. Real assistance was wanted, they said in Helsinki, not ineffective words of praise or blame. The Chinese were a little bitter, for exactly opposite reasons. They had been pressing Geneva for 8 years, without ever getting action, even as strong as this, against Japan. The Czechs and Austrians could not have been very happy either. When they lost their independence, the League had confined itself to vague expressions of regret. And the Poles, they remembered that the League of Nations simply omitted its annual assembly session last September, just as the war was getting underway. Thus, the League's expulsion of Russia contrasts very sharply with other moves in its recent history. Many people are asking why the League at this moment adopted a stronger position than it has ever taken before, with the exception of the sanctions drive against Italy, which proved ineffective. There are at least three explanations. First, the League undoubtedly moved quickly to forestall any attempt by Russia to withdraw of its own accord. You will remember that Japan and Italy responded to the disapproval of Geneva by leaving the League with a flurry of publicity. In each case, the result was humiliating for the League. Today, at least, the League has the satisfaction, however empty, of saving its own prestige by applying the covenant before it can be flouted. The second reason for the expulsion of Russia is, I believe, a desire by the British and French to head off even stronger measures against the USSR. In Britain and France, as in America, there are people who want to take the strongest possible steps against the Soviet Union for reasons quite unconnected with the Finnish situation. The idea of a crusade against communism was born with the formation of the Bolshevik government in 1917. It has never died. By invading Finland, the Soviets have given the rest of the world a golden opportunity to revive it. But officials in London and Paris seem to realize that there is nothing to be gained by taking on a second enemy when they are still deadlocked in their fight with Nazi Germany. The British and French, by simply putting the Soviet Union beyond the pale at Geneva, are able to say to the anti-communist elements at home that they have already taken all possible effective action. The third reason for Russia's expulsion is probably most important of all. At the assembly meeting, the Argentine delegate, Rodolfo Freire, issued a virtual ultimatum to the League itself. If Russia was not expelled, he said in so many words, Argentina would withdraw. The three other South American states remaining in the League intimated that they would also leave. When it came to a choice between the Soviets and the Americans, there could be no doubt of what the League would do. These things explain the League's sharp treatment of the Soviet Union. But do they justify it? Without for a moment condoning the Soviets' attack on Finland, many Americans will wonder whether the expulsion of Russia was wise. It represents no concrete gain for anyone outside the moral sphere. The whole proceeding was carried on without any expression of the Soviet point of view, although it is true, of course, that Moscow refused to plead its case. But more than this, the expulsion of the USSR might just possibly drive it into the arms of the other aggressor states, Germany, Japan, and Italy. In this particular instance, the attitude of Argentina raises a number of questions. The Argentine delegate declared that his government was determined to oppose the decay of moral values by defending moral rights against the brute rule of force. In practice, the Argentinians, like many other Latin American members of the League, have not always been in the forefront of those who urged strong action on behalf of victims of aggression. It is interesting to remember that Argentina's record is not one of perfect cooperation with Geneva. Strangely enough, away back in 1920, the Argentinians withdrew their delegate from the League Assembly because, among other things, the League at that time would not admit the Soviet Union to membership. At that time, the Argentinians contended that the League, to be effective and to avoid creation of two opposing international blocs, must include every power willing to join. And so, for 8 years, Argentina was for all practical purposes a non-member state. So Argentina, after staying out because all states were not admitted, last week threatened to leave if Russia were not expelled. On the other hand, there was a reason for the growing indifference of the South American states toward the League. In recent years, they have greatly strengthened the Pan-American peace machinery for settlement of their own problems. It was only natural for the Latin American states to lose interest in the League as their Pan-American ties became more important. Pan-American solidarity reached its high point to date in the Conference of the American Republics at Panama City, September 23rd. At this conference, the delegates, under the leadership of the United States, took a novel step in the practice of neutrality. By the Declaration of Panama, adopted October 3rd, they announced that they had an inherent right to insist that no European belligerent should commit a hostile act on, over, or under the waters ordinarily used by vessels plying back and forth between the Americas. They marked off on the map a neutral zone or safety belt, extending at most points hundreds of miles from the American coasts. They agreed to urge the belligerents not to engage in hostilities within it. They said they would consult together if the declaration were not observed, but they didn't say just what they would do in that case. On October 14th last, the British Admiralty politely but firmly refused to recognize this safety zone. The Germans did the same. And by all the rules of international law, both are, of course, perfectly justified. In war as in peace, the seas outside the 3-mile limit of territorial waters remain a free highway, open to all. This is a commonly acknowledged principle, one which the United States itself has maintained on innumerable occasions. When British ships continued to search neutral merchant vessels off the South American shores, it became pretty clear that they were going to challenge the Declaration of Panama. When the Admiral Graf Spee and 3 British cruisers came to blows within sight of the Uruguayan coast, the issue was squarely presented to the American republics. The greatest test that Pan-Americanism has recently had to meet now looms in the immediate future. Are we going to acquiesce in naval conflicts within the safety belt? Is the Declaration of Panama worth more than the paper on which it is written? And if we are to enforce it, how can that be done? The American republics may, of course, continue to use diplomatic methods alone to induce the belligerents to withdraw, for war purposes, from Western Hemisphere waters. But it seems doubtful that this will bring results. Are we then prepared, we American republics, to seek some other means of preventing Britain and Germany from fighting it out anywhere beyond the old 3-mile limit? Perhaps the only way to make the Declaration of Panama effective is to set American warships ready for action all along the Atlantic coast of the Americas. No matter what the ultimate decision is, the Uruguayan government has an immediate issue on its hands which may cause it considerable embarrassment. If the Admiral Graf Spee does not wish to be interned in Montevideo, it must leave that harbor in about 3 hours. There, for the last 3 days, its crew have been feverishly working to repair the damage suffered in the naval battle of last Wednesday. Meanwhile, the Uruguayan government has been subjected to the strongest pressure by both the British and the Germans. The British have maintained that the Graf Spee should have been forced to leave the harbor 24 hours after its arrival. The Germans demand that the ship be allowed to remain until all repairs are completed. The Uruguayan authorities, caught in this diplomatic crossfire, appear to have kept their heads and to have made a wise decision. They have faithfully applied the rules of the 13th Hague Convention on the Treatment of Belligerent Warships, signed by Uruguay, Britain, and Germany in 1907. According to this convention, the naval vessels of warring powers cannot remain in a neutral port for more than 24 hours. But if they are damaged, they may remain longer to carry out only those repairs absolutely necessary to render them seaworthy. Uruguayan naval officers therefore examined the vessel and allowed 72 hours for repair work necessary for this purpose. During the World War, the United States, while neutral, did very much the same thing. It gave 3 German vessels periods of from 6 days to 3 weeks to make certain specified repairs in its harbors. In all 3 cases, the German commanders chose to stay beyond the permitted time limit, and, acting quite properly, the American authorities interned the vessels, that is, held them in our ports for the duration of the war. Thus, the Uruguayans are following in well-traveled paths of neutral procedure when they force the Graf Spee to leave this evening or remain at Montevideo until the end of the war. It is highly desirable that they should do so, for only by strict observance of the rules, with complete impartiality, can small neutral states even hope to remain safe in today's wars. But we must not forget that the problem of making the American safety belt really effective still remains unsolved, and that it is only a part of the larger question of the whole attitude of the American states, including ourselves, toward all of Europe's conflicts.
You have been listening to Mr. David H. Popper, Research Associate of the Foreign Policy Association, speaking in their series of broadcasts entitled America Looks Abroad. These broadcasts will continue to be given at this hour on Sunday afternoon by different officers and staff members of the association. If you are interested in world problems, send for a free copy of the weekly bulletin, which is written by the people you hear on this program. Address your letter or postcard to the Foreign Policy Association, number 8 West 40th Street, New York City. Mrs. Vera Michelis Dean will be the next speaker in this series next Sunday afternoon at 3:15 on most of these stations. For your convenience, I might repeat that address, the Foreign Policy Association, number 8 West 40th Street, New York City. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.